This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Now our final segment in the sentencing of Taylor Shabusiness today in Brown County, Wisconsin, in Green Bay. Let's take a listen.
Your Honor, my client will make some comments as part of her right of elocution after the arguments of counsel.
Okay. All right. Very good. My thought had been that if Ms. Shabusiness was going to testify, we'd probably take a break for lunch and come back. But given that she's not going to testify, she's going to use her right of elocution. My thought is we just proceed right to arguments and then sentencing. Any objection to that, Mr. Saunders?
No, that's fine.
Mr. Frelick?
No, that's fine.
All right. So then, I know, Mr. Saunders, you had indicated there was something regarding the victim impact statement you wanted to do. Was it going to be read in, or how did you want to handle that?
I believe now two family members of the victim wish to orally address the court judge.
Okay.
I think just orally is a victim impact statement. So.
Very good. And if they want to come up and stand, there's a microphone right above. If you want to stand right between those two pillars there, they can stand right there. And if you could just tell me your name first, sir.
Kelly Therian. Chad's uncle. I basically just wanted to say that there's no excuse for what you've done. I don't care if it's drugs or upbringing, you know. We all go through hard times growing up, at least the majority of us have. You have the opportunity to change that. You have the opportunity to, you know, see that you have a problem. There's, you know, I've been in recovery a little over 3 years. In AA, I drank for 41 years. I realized I had a problem. So there's just, basically to me, you took the easy way out. You did the most cowardly, weakest things that you could do possible. You know, you meet a person in school, you say he's your friend, you become friends, become girlfriend, boyfriend, lovers, gain his trust, an innocent person that's very kind, would do anything for you. And I believe you used that and you had this plan and took your opportunity when you did. There's no excuse, you know, I don't see it no other way. To take advantage of someone's kindness like that, that's like the most irritating thing for me. You know, you get to know somebody and they trust you, and then you do that. You say that you're a friend, you're his friend, you said that in the statements. It's like, man. But, you know, I walked into a program and it's free. You know, you can go get help and it's free. All over the place there's help. And it doesn't cost a dime, you know. It's either, and the first thing they tell you in there, you know, you want to continue doing what you're doing. It's going to be jail, institution, or death. And you chose that path. And you chose the wrong path. They sit here talking about being rehabilitated. Is Shad's mother going to ever rehabilitate from this? No, but you can go to an institution. You can go to prison and try to be rehabilitated. But I don't see no reason why you'd have parole after the doctor had just mentioned, once you have so much damage that it's irreversible, you know, so why would don't make no sense to me even to have the option of parole to come back and to gain someone's trust like that again, you know, because that is like the lowest thing a person could do. You know what I mean? I just don't understand that. And the biggest thing is, you know, like I said, you know, the help is free, and it's there. You chose not to take, you know, yeah, I'm sure you knew you had a problem, you know. You can't blame it on childhood. You know, there's help out there. And if you take the path to go get the help, you wouldn't be in this situation right now. None of us would be in this situation. But to take the cowardly path that you did and to make other people suffer because you were suffering is pretty shitty. So that name Taylor Shabusiness fits you well. And I'm not a praying man, but after Judge Walsh here sentences today, I will pray that you meet the same fate as your idolistic Jeffrey Dahmer. So have a good life, shit business.
The next speaker will be a statutory crime victim, so we'd ask the media be advised of that, Judge.
Okay. I just want to, all right, they're indicating they are going to make sure that they're not duty. If you could just, sir, before you start, if you just state your name for the record.
Michael Therian.
Okay, go ahead.
Taylor, I just wanted to say that I forgive you for what you've done to my son. And, you made a bad choice, and now you have to live with it. But, you know, I'm going to miss Shad. He was a wonderful child, too. He, growing up, just mild-mannered and just happy. And I know you made a bad choice. And like I said, I forgive you. And I'm going to ask the judge if he can, you know, if she can see the streets again sometime, you know. It may not be soon, but I believe everybody makes bad choices, and maybe not to the scale, but I think there's a lot of hope for you. I think, you know, you can make use of your time and be a better person and do great things, yet, you know, so it does no good for me to hate you, you know. I know you got a heart, I know you got a mind. And I wish you no harm, and I hope things go well for you. That's all I got to say.
Okay, thank you. Any other witnesses or people I want to speak, Mr. Saunders?
No, I don't believe so.
Very good. Then I'll turn to the state for a sentencing recommendation.
Thank you. So ultimately, the state's recommendation is that the defendant not be eligible for release at any point on to extended supervision. And obviously, we're here for legally and morally the most serious offense somebody can commit in this state. Really, I think a few points bear emphasis. I'm not going to rehash the entire trial testimony for the court, but I do think a few points bear emphasis. Really, the manner and nature of which Mr. Business caused Shad's death in this case, I think, is really one of the more egregious, frankly, incomprehensible methods of ending another person's life that we've seen in this county and certainly in a significant period of time. So it's one thing we sometimes see intentional homicides where there is a bad choice. There is a decision in a moment of anger or whatever it is to pull a trigger on a gun or to hit somebody in anger. And while that intent exists when they're committing that act or when they're pulling that trigger, it's sometimes rather fleeting. The manner, as we heard from the defendant herself, explain how she ended Chad's life. This really wasn't a bad decision. It was a series of conscious efforts. It was continued effort over, as she said, 3 to 5 minutes, as she's telling and describing for Detective Groff and Detective Kemp, pantomiming how she's pulling harder, how she's glibly talking about how he's turning purple, and I liked it. I'm pulling harder. He's coughing up blood. I'm pulling harder. I kept going. I was waiting for him to die. This really is an involved process. It's a method of ending another person's life that really is quite significant, and I think evinces some significant concerns going forward, both in looking at, you know, the nature of the offense, as we have to, but in looking at some of the other factors the court's to consider, in which I'll be commenting on earlier. It's really one of the most horrific ways to end a person's life. And again, it's bad enough to do it to anyone, but as we heard, there was this level of trust and friendship and familiarity between the two, which I think is just really makes the acts of the defendant really incomprehensible in that respect. You have obviously the method of ending his life was significant and serious, but after the fact, not realizing, you know, in the course of this conduct, her actions are going too far, to the opposite, actually going further, as I commented on earlier, but not then owning up to what happened, not realizing the impact of her subsequent acts would have on Shad and his memory, on his family, on this community, really, to engage in the acts that she did with his body, which I'm not going to comment on what those are. The court and counselor are aware of what happened and the systematic and organized and laborious efforts she undertook. That's nothing we've seen in this county. I can't imagine in many counties have seen acts of callous brutality like that. I do think that's an extremely aggravating factor. I recall Dr. Tranquita's testimony from trial talking about the amount of effort and volition and choice that would have to be done to undergo what the defendant did over a period of hours. This was not, one bad choice in some respects. It was the choice to end his life in the first place, certainly a bad choice, but continued bad choices throughout the next day, throughout the morning and into the night, where she's finally stopped by law enforcement. It's really the three convictions that Ms. Business was convicted of, I think, are just really some of the more egregious conduct that the court will sentence a person on for some time. We saw, the court saw the entire 8-hour interview in the course of the litigation. We saw a portion or portions of that interview as she's describing this to law enforcement. And really, we see really from moment one, and that continued throughout the pendency of the proceedings in the case, to her comments in the PSI. We'll see what the allocution is today, but really a lack of remorse or understanding or appreciation, I guess, is in some respects, of the conduct that she's engaging in. We saw her calmly describe what happened, at some points being rather glib and smirking about what she had done. As we see later in the PSI, having very little remorse for what she's done. And ultimately, the defendant, we've heard a lot about drug use and mental health history, which I'll comment on later. But really, the defendant herself is telling us why this happened. And it wasn't because methamphetamine. It wasn't because of mental illness. She's telling law enforcement why this happened. It happened because she liked it. It's because she wanted to do it. And again, throughout the entirety of this case, we see this underlying motive is essentially, it's kind of consistent, right? We see, and we've seen acts of acting out, both in court and to examiners who are seeing her. It's consistent in the state's view with a lack of remorse, of understanding, of the conduct that she engaged in. And I think that's all consistent. I think it's all an aggravating circumstance for the court to consider at sentencing. And I want to talk, too, because impact on the crime victims is a factor the court considered. And I want to comment on that in two respects. First, perseverance of this family to have the attitude they have about the case and about Taylor is admirable. To hear the things they've had to hear and experience the things they've had to experience, I think is tremendous. So the thought of the defendant having perpetrated this act and impacting them in that way, I think is incredibly concerning. I also, it was heartening as I've been the prosecutor for many months on this case and in reading the PSI, getting to know more about Shad, and I want to comment on that because unfortunately the case we've heard, really everything we've heard about him has been in the context of what Taylor did to him. And it's really unfortunate that that's the memory that some people will have about him. And again, that's a result of the defendant's acts to, in some respects, really tinge the memory that some may have of him. And I don't want that to be the case. But we heard the good. We heard how he was a good and quiet kid, how he would always hug his dad on the way out of before he left the house, how he would read and knit and crochet with his younger sister. And that's the person the defendant took out of this world. You know, for all the talk about how young the defendant is, Shad was 24 when he passed. So all the things we hear the defendant wants to experience in life, she still has that opportunity in a confined setting. And simply put, Shad does not. So the impact on the crime victims, I think, is significant. We then look at Bishop Business's character. I guess I'll first comment on the prior history, which we consider, and I guess we're also sentencing on. There are three prior convictions. She was just placed on probation 6 weeks before this offense, and appropriately so. In reviewing the complaints, she kicked an officer. There's indications of methamphetamine or other substance abuse that led to that conduct. She then, in the fleeing case, fled at 80 miles an hour down the downtown Green Bay when it's populated with bar patrons and other pedestrians walking down the street. She's hopping curbs. She's not stopping. She's blowing through red lights. Again, there was indicia that drug use was at play there. And those were both in 2020. So as we heard earlier, there was ample time. And in reviewing the materials, efforts were made to address the underlying substance abuse issues. She was placed on probation, and really nothing of much was accomplished in that short period of time. The little that was accomplished, she absconded from electronic monitoring. She cut off the bracelet and really then obviously engaged in this conduct. So the state agrees that, you know, considering this idea of rehabilitation, and that's always a goal, but in some respects, that opportunity was afforded both during the criminal cases and in reviewing all of the materials at many points throughout her life, and unfortunately either was not followed through with, was not taken seriously, and I think that's a concern going forward. We consider the background of the defendant, and I echo the comments earlier. That's not a childhood. That's not an early adolescence that anyone should have to go through. And that's, you know, it's really difficult to hear some of that stuff. But when we consider that sort of background information, unfortunately, we deal with a lot of people who have substance abuse issues in the criminal justice system that lead them to make choices they wouldn't normally make, that leads them to become thieves or become burglars or become misdemeanor offenders. Really, I'm not sure we have a nexus here between that underlying substance issue or mental health history and the conduct that we're sentencing her for today. Certainly, we've had a lot of litigation or testimony about the mental health history of the defendant. The court appointed experts called a majority of that into doubt, and obviously the jury disagreed that there was any mental disease or defect that led to this behavior. And I comment on that because, you know, it's one thing just to say this person has a mental health history or a substance abuse history, and that's important to note, but really why that's relevant at sentencing is it's sometimes a nexus or it's a explanation for one's conduct that maybe then would lead towards maybe rehabilitative efforts. I'm not sure in the case there's that nexus between you know, the prior drug history, mental health history to the extent there is one, and the defendant's conduct here. It appears there was methamphetamine use. We don't know how much, and we don't know, given some of the comments of the defendant after the fact, how much that impacted her decision-making. Certainly probably didn't help, but the doctor said today, we've now had this long period of essentially forced sobriety, and we're seeing aberrant behavior throughout that time. Certainly, obviously, nothing to the extent of what she did to Shad, but I comment on that because, yes, there are those histories, and rehabilitation is always a goal of the criminal justice system, and I would think most people in the public and in the state certainly would agree with that, that as a first option, as a response to addiction, to low-level offenses, rehabilitation is a primary goal. Rehabilitation, while important, should not be a primary goal for the court in this case. And I say that in part because of what the defendant did. I think criteria like punishment and deterrence and protection of the public are more primary factors. But it was very concerning to not only hear the defendant talk about the offense to law enforcement, but the comments that were made in the pre-sentence report, which, as I mentioned, I think evinced just an utter lack of remorse for what happened. And it's relevant, a lack of remorse, to one's character. Obviously, if somebody's remorseful for their conduct, that reflects favorably on their character, and the state would be the first to acknowledge when that's the case. Here, not only do we have a lack of that, we have really the opposite. We have the defendant in the PSI on page 7 saying, quote, "I don't have any regrets about what I did, and I do not feel remorseful for Shad." So the state's concern really is more, comments like that go more towards protection of the public and an ultimate question for the court of whether this is a person who should be afforded the opportunity to be released. Because really, lack of remorse in many respects is more fundamental to protection of the public and those sort of criteria. And that's because understanding, appreciating, being remorseful of one's conduct helps that rehabilitation effort, and it helps ultimately then protection of the public. If you're not acknowledging what you did and that it was bad and that you should feel bad to the victim who did what the defendant did to the victim, why should there ever be a potential for release, to be released back into the community without that understanding? That's step one in the rehabilitation effort. And we don't have that yet. And really, we have something completely contrary to that. And that's extremely concerning. So in that respect, I agree with the Department of Corrections in the case. They're recommending Mr. Business not be eligible for release, and the state's joining in that. I've reviewed the defense PSI from Mr. Hyland and Ms. Nitz, who were retained. They acknowledge in some respects the logical course would be to not be released without the possibility of release, but they come to a different conclusion for really three reasons, and I wanted to comment on that. First, they comment that she has a documented history of mental health issues, including hallucinations, ideations, extreme emotional highs and lows, things like that. I do think that's inconsistent with the expert testimony from the court-appointed witnesses in the case, from Dr. Engen from Dr. Seipel. Really, I commented on Dr. Seipel's quote to the doctor earlier in his testimony. I'm not sure if that's the case here. I think it's fair to say some of the beliefs are questioning the behavior that we're seeing, wondering if it's volitional, some doctors even being more forceful in that opinion, that it is, that it's fundamentally volitional choices that the defendant's making. Dr. Seipel found, you know, no credible evidence in that, and we're not here to litigate that. I comment on that because if that's one of the basis to conclude that she is eligible for release, I don't know if that's consistent with the evidence that the court's been presented in the case. Second, her intense use of methamphetamine just prior to the offense. Again, I don't know how much of an impact that had. Certainly, we heard about sometimes meth use can cause those gaps in memories and things like that. That's not consistent with what we saw. We saw, to whatever extent the defendant used methamphetamine leading up to the offense. First of all, I don't know if we know what impact that had. And second of all, I don't know how it alleviates the defendant's responsibility or alleviates or gives rise to this notion that if we just have her, you know, be treated, that this wouldn't happen again if she was released into the community. I don't know if that nexus is there in this case. The third consideration they commented on is her present inability to fully process and acknowledge the act she engaged in, noting that it appears to come from her reviewing the reports generated by law enforcement. And again, the court's seen the interview. Her recollection and appreciation and understanding of what she did is evident from moment one. It's not from reviewing police reports. In many respects, she was leading the investigation. She knew more than Detective Groff and Detective Kemp. She's pointing out where everything is. She's providing accurate information that's corroborated by law enforcement on the scene. So this notion that this is somehow she's not fully processed what's going on, not only is that contrary to the evidence, the evidence we have is that she has processed and she simply does not care or appreciate what she did. And I think that's consistent with her comments in the PSI. It's consistent in her attitude and comments to law enforcement in both interviews. And again, I talked about this at length in talking about her remorse, but that gives significant pause. This was not a person who was psychologically unable to understand what she was doing. She knew exactly what she was doing. The jury agreed. And I think that's evident from the evidence in the case. So they also talk about, you know, this denying the eligibility of release is to reject the possibility that there may be advancements in the future. And certainly that's potentially the case. We have no idea what Ms. Business will be like in 2040, 2050, 2060. But that's just one of the factors the courts can consider. To only think in those terms neglects the other criteria, neglects what she actually did in this case, the moral need for punishment, the need for deterrence, the need to protect the public from somebody doing that to another person in this community. So sure, rehabilitation is always an effort, and hopefully in a confined setting that can be accomplished to some extent. But that's not the only criteria. The only criteria is, can we correct this behavior? We also have to address what she actually did. And what she did, as I commented on, is significant. So really, in light of these circumstances, I think the department's recommendation for Ms. Chavizas not to be eligible for release is appropriate. There are select cases where the legislature has determined that somebody in the court's discretion should not be eligible for release into the community again. And looking at the criteria and what the defendant did in this case, that's seemingly... this case seems to be kind of made for that sort of a result, what the legislature had in mind in crafting that possibility. So I believe the state should exercise its, or sorry, the court should exercise its sentencing discretion and deny the eligibility for release. I think in that event, the sentences on the other counts are perhaps moot, but I think the PSI's recommendation for consecutive sentences on the other matters are appropriate. The sentencing after revocation, I'll just agree with the department. They recommend a year in jail. That's appropriate. But really, you know, the preeminent case is obviously the case we're here for today. So that's all I have to say. There's credit, but we'll wait till the end. So thank you.
Okay. Mr. Frelich.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. There's a lot of information that the court has to sift through and assess and analyze in this case. We've got the State of Wisconsin Department of Corrections pre-sentence investigation report. We also have the Forte Investigations independent PSI, or pre-sentence investigation report. The court heard some testimony from family members, my client's cousin, her father, her grandmother, Dr. O'Donnell. What we have here is a horrific situation that happened. It can't be undone. Certainly, the defense agrees that Taylor Denise Shabizness has to be punished, but she's a young person. She's 25 years old. We can't undo what happened. What we know is that she's got family that supports her, that loves her, family in Texas, family in Ohio, extended family out there. They're all willing to try and help Taylor whatever way they can. I think that my client, Your Honor, is not a throwaway. She's not a monster. She's certainly got problems, and over time, I think she can get control over her problems, get help, get rehabilitation, and also be punished. Clearly, when during the trial, the court saw the videotape footage, and when the Green Bay police detectives and officers came to the Eastman Avenue apartment and they made contact with Taylor out on the porch or on the steps, and then had her go back inside and sit down on the stairs, you could tell that she was high on drugs. And then eventually she was questioned and taken out to the police squad car for further questioning down at the Green Bay Police Department. But Taylor is not a throwaway. She's a human being. It's not an eye for an eye. I'm very impressed by Michael Therrien, Shad Therrien's father. He has a huge heart, and he forgives my client for what happened. And he, from what I heard, believes that he thinks that that my client should be given the opportunity for parole or extended supervision down sometime in the future. And I'd ask that the court consider that. He's the victim in this case, and what he asks of the court should be strongly considered. I have a client who is very young. She's a young woman. She has severe mental health problems. It's the elephant in the room. We can't ignore it. She's got all kinds of mental health problems. They have been bore out in the records from Prevea Health, from Nicolet Psychiatric Center, from Bellin Health. She was under a civil commitment order in 2021 and under an order to take psychotropic medication. And this young lady has a lot of mental health issues that need intensive treatment and counseling over time. She is a dual diagnosis client or patient. She has severe drug addiction issues, marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamine. She apparently used it where she smoked it, where she used it through an IV intravenously. She's had problems for a long time with drugs, and that's an issue that really needs immediate attention by professionals. But this has never been about an eye for an eye. It's about fairness and justice, that my client should be punished, but she should also be given the opportunity to have a chance at the possibility of extended supervision or parole supervision sometime in the future after she gets help. This was one incident. I would argue that my client should not necessarily receive separate punishments, although we have convictions for three separate crimes, but it was an incident that occurred on one particular date, February 22nd of 2022, that the sentences should be concurrent. I would argue, Your Honor, and ask the court to consider the fact that this was likely a meth-fueled type of incident on the date of this tragedy. shouldn't have happened, but it did happen. As far as looking at my client's life, she was born in Evanston, Illinois, Chicago area, moved with family to Green Bay, Wisconsin in 2008, went to school here in the community, went to high school here at Bayport, and then at some point she went to live in Texas with her grandparents, and then came back. I would argue that Taylor Shabizis has redeeming social value. She's got the ability to do artwork. She's like soccer. She's like swimming. She's able to function independently. She's of average intelligence. She's got adequate written and verbal skills. She's a high school graduate from Cotulla High School in Texas, where she graduated in 2016. She was very good in different classes like social studies, physical education, science, economics. She's had different kinds of jobs, as a cook for Big Beef City in 2012-2013. She worked for Tour Temple in Texas in 2012. She worked for Saputo Cheese for about 3 years in 2017-2020, making about $21 an hour. She worked for Seek Staffing. When she was in Texas, she was apparently a maintenance supervisor where she made close to maybe $32 an hour. And she was certified for employment purposes in sanitation, forklift, driving, pallet jacking, safety locks, things of that sort. So she's able to do well. Those pictures, the family sent those pictures to me and I sent them to the court. I think the pictures show Taylor as a youngster, as a teenager, and as an adult, that she's got family that loves her, that supports her, that she is needed, and that she can form relationships, and that she's capable of love. I think that Mr. Coronado, it's unfortunate of his situation, but he indicated to the pre-sentence writer that Taylor was a good person, kind-hearted, helped others out, that Taylor struggled after her mom, Marla, passed away in 2009. Taylor Shabizis has suffered a significant amount of loss in her life. She lost her mom, Marla, in 2009, lost her brother, AJ, in 2022 from a motorcycle accident. You heard about the other losses from the cousin that testified. My client has a little boy, Mateo, who's age one, and he's living with Juan and Esther Coronado in Temple, Texas. Those pictures speak a thousand words. You could see that Taylor was delighted to have that baby come into her life. She kissed his head. She hugged the baby. She was happy with being around her grandparents. You could see that she was close with her brother, AJ. All of these pictures show that she has had a good life where she got love and support from family. The tragedy, the fact that she has these losses, I don't think they were ever really addressed in counseling, but they eroded her mental health. And she had underlying problems besides all of that. My client certainly has a prior record, but it's not a long record. It's not a record where she assaults people and things of that sort. In looking at the independent pre-sentence investigation report from Paul Hyland, those writers, Mr. Hyland and Carrie Nitz, a CID, licensed abuse counselor, indicates that Ms. Shabizis' present inability to fully process and acknowledge the acts that she engaged in on February 22, 2022 exists. My client has these mental health problems. She's not getting treatment in the jail. She's not apparently on any medications and probably needs to be. She needs to see professionals to help her address some of these problems that she has. But with the proper treatment, with the proper medication, with the proper counseling, I think she can turn it around and do great things like her father, Arturo Coronado, testified to. She's not a lost cause, Your Honor. And the writers from Forte Investigations indicates at this time, presently, she's unable to psychologically fathom the crimes that she committed during her mental state on February 22nd of 2022. I agree with that. I don't think she is currently able to do that. She's going to need some treatment to process all of this. She was likely in a drug-induced delusional state at the time that that happened. And you even heard from Dr. James O'Donnell, who has a lot of experience dealing with methamphetamine use and chemicals and all of that. He indicated that chronic methamphetamine use causes cognitive impairment. It impairs cognition, can cause violent behavior, delusions, hallucinations, some cases psychosis, and a loss of touch with reality. And I would argue that that's likely what happened here. Likely would not have happened if my client was not using drugs with Mr. Therrien. And it's my client's fault that this happened, and she has to be held accountable for that. But the court needs to take that into consideration here. And, you know, the court has the discretion to do whatever the court feels is appropriate, taking into account all of the sentencing factors. And, you know, punishing my client for decades like the Forte investigation independent PSI recommends is appropriate. She can be punished, but at some point she should maybe be given the chance or the possibility of being on extended supervision. Because to deny the possibility of consideration for extended supervision in the future is to reject the possibility that there may be advancements in medicine, in psychology, in therapy. Maybe certain medications can fix some of the problems that she has. This is a very complicated case from a psychological, from a mental health standpoint, from a medical standpoint. And I would argue that my client should be given the opportunity to live her later years possibly outside of a confined setting. That it'll give her incentive to work hard in counseling, in therapy, participating in interviews with professionals to try and get a better understanding of the crime and the factors that contributed to it. And the possibility of parole, like Mr. Hyland says, is not synonymous to the probability of parole. We're just asking the court to consider the possibility of her being afforded extended supervision or parole in the future, sometime in the future, after thousands of hours of therapy, after thousands of hours of counseling, after possibly taking prescribed medications, following the strict adherence to the medication regimen. My client apparently doesn't seem to have much in the way of a violence in her life, threats to people, and only after an extended period of time of living appropriately, vigilantly, could she have the possibility of being considered for supervised release. So I agree with what Mr. Hyland and Ms. Nitz have to say about their recommendations, and I'd ask that you consider that, Your Honor. I'd ask that the sentences for counts 1, 2, and 3 all be concurrent to each other, as recommended by Forte Investigations, and that I'd ask that you consider granting her consideration for extended supervision, make her complete a mental health assessment, comply with all recommendations, have her complete an AODA assessment and follow those recommendations, submit a DNA sample that's required under Wisconsin law. I think that Forte Investigations did a very good job, a very detailed analysis of my client's problems. They did an alcohol and other psychoactive substance abuse evaluation and concluded and opined that my client has a history of using mind-altering substances, that her that she had some losses in her life, but that she also had some good parts of her life where she graduated from high school, had a baby, had jobs, It talks about the history of using substances. And I took some notes on that. Well, it looks like she started using alcohol at age 6 and then continued onward with using marijuana, maybe at about 14 or so, and then got into stimulants, the methamphetamine, and started using methamphetamine at age 21. You know, using these drugs, the methamphetamine is probably one of the worst drugs you can possibly use, but it changes your brain. It changes the chemical composition of your brain. It causes all kinds of problems. She used marijuana for sometimes almost daily until she got to be 21. So you can understand maybe how her thinking and her judgment and her ability to process was completely impaired. And then you add another layer of the mental health problems. Of course, it's going to create hallucinations and auditory and visual hallucinations where she doesn't go to sleep, stays up all night, stays up for days on end. Certainly, she was under the influence of methamphetamines at the time of this offense. And she really hasn't had much in the way of treatment. I think treatment could help fix or reduce some of the problems that she has. I think she's open to it because she tried it in the past. And maybe she resorted to drugs, Your Honor, because that's what she saw her mother do as far as using alcohol or other things, and that's how they coped. You know, you learn from your parents. My client, apparently, according to Carrie Nitz, meets the criteria for substance misuse diagnosis, and all the different diagnoses are as follows: alcohol use disorder, cannabis use disorder, severe opioid use disorder, morphine, stimulant use disorder, methamphetamine, stimulant use disorder, crack cocaine. And that Carrie Nitz, NITZ, recommends that Ms. Shabizis engage in treatment in a residential or inpatient service program where she can receive intensive services in a structured environment with a focus geared towards motivational and intervention strategies, as well as promotion of recovery and close monitoring of sobriety. And it's recommended that these services be received duly with the services to address her significant mental health-related issues. Providing these kinds of services and recommendations, it may be possible for Taylor Shabizis to obtain control of her life, engage in meaningful relationships with others, and adequately address her substance misuse, and which could possibly change the direction of her life, benefiting her and the criminal justice system. I think it would be a tragedy to, as an argument on behalf of my client, to give her life in prison without the possibility of parole. I think that the court should definitely take into account what the defense is recommending, what the independent pre-sentence investigation is recommending, and what Michael Therrien is recommending. I don't believe that my client is or wanted to do this or liked doing it. I think that she really wasn't able to completely understand or fathom what was going on. And when she was talking to detectives from the Green Bay Police Department, she was still hopped up on drugs. Her mind just wasn't thinking straight. How could it? But she was cooperative and told law enforcement what happened, gave them information that helped with their investigation. The fact that she was cooperative should be considered by the court. I calculated the jail credit, and she was arrested on February 22nd of 2022. So through today, I come up with 581 days of credit. I talked to my client. I don't know how many hits of meth she took. She indicated maybe it was 51 hits prior to the incident, but she took a lot of meth. I would argue and submit that the more you use, the worse it gets, especially if you have an underlying mental health problem. And the underlying mental health problem, as Dr. O'Donnell states, it was exacerbated by the heavy use of drugs. And, you know, the doctors and the state, it seems like, other than Dr. Lighton, who said that woman is psychotic, all the other doctors seem to think that, oh, my client does not have a mental health diagnosis or a mental health issue, and she does. That's why she was under a court order under the state of Wisconsin for a civil commitment and a medication order. I would also argue that the fact that she used marijuana at a young age, 12, 13, 14, whatever it was, and whether it was daily or not, it likely changed the chemical composition of her brain and made her incapable of making rational decision. Her brain, her thought process, her ability to think rationally all got eroded over time. And, Your Honor, there are aggravating factors here, but there are also mitigating factors. And I would argue that Taylor Denise Shabusiness has many redeeming social qualities. She could turn her life around with counseling, with education, support of her family, support of her dad, support of her aunt and cousin that's in the courtroom, with medication management through a psychiatrist or psychologist or therapist or doctor, possibly getting back on injectable antipsychotic medications to treat her psychiatric and other problems, get into criminal thinking classes in the prison, maybe have a full psychiatric evaluation, and have a structured daily regimen. This young lady, I've worked with her for quite a long time. I've seen a lot of positive things in her. And I think that part of it has been the drugs were just clouding everything, where she couldn't think straight and just wasn't making right decisions. But she can turn it around. She can make better decisions in the future with help. And I think there is a nexus between her substance abuse problem and mental health history. Certainly my client needs punishment. The public needs to be protected. But also a factor is rehabilitation. And after time, after years, she should be given that opportunity to be released under supervision of the Department of Corrections. She'll need close rehabilitative control, but she deserves a chance. And I mean, the court has to weigh the scales of justice. We see them all the time. From testimony, from records, from arguments, from exhibits, and from what people say, what victims say, what Michael Therrien says. So I would ask that you consider these arguments on behalf of my client, Your Honor, as to the recommendations of Forte Investigations. I'd ask that you go along with that, ask that it all be concurrent, give her the credit that I already stated. And as to the revocation manner, defense would agree that she should receive 1 year in jail. We ask that it be concurrent to any other sentence. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, Ms. Shabusiness, this is your opportunity to address me. If there's anything on your mind you'd like to say before I pass sentence.
No, there isn't.
Okay. Very good. Well, then, when passing sentence on cases like this, the court has to consider the factors set forth in State versus Galleon. So I have to consider the gravity of the offense, the character of the defendant, the need to protect the public, as well as other aggravating and mitigating circumstances, including rehabilitative needs and punishment and deterrence, and then craft a sentence in each case that's appropriate. In this case, when I consider the defendant's character, I can say that over the course of this case, I've learned a great deal about you, Ms. Shabusiness. First of all, you were born in Chicago and lived there until you were about age 10, or 12 rather. You seem to have had a stable childhood. You were loved by your mother and your father and your brother. And unfortunately, your mother passed away when you were 12, your brother passed away from a vehicle accident, and your dad's incarcerated. But I'm confident that all three of them probably still love you very much. Her father's employment was transferred to Green Bay when she was about 12 years old, and hence began the contact Ms. Shabusiness had with this community. She attended Bayport High School. At about 16, she moved to Texas to live with her grandmother, grandfather. She graduated from high school in Cotulla, Texas, and eventually came back to Green Bay because she missed her father and her brother, which, again, doesn't surprise me any because, as I've indicated, I think they both love her very much. She's worked in this community. I read over the pre-sentence investigation report that I ordered, and that outlines some work experience that she has, and I think that's a favorable character trait because, quite frankly, not everyone that lives in this community does work. And I think it indicates someone who wants to get out and support themselves and not make anybody else do it. But that reflects on character. She has a limited court record. Certainly we have pretty much the entire extent of her criminal record in front of us here today. But it's a limited record that reflects on character. She's got a family who cares about her. And although sometimes I think people take that for granted, if you sit in this courtroom long enough, you'll realize that you should never take your family for granted because so many people come in sitting in that chair in an orange jumpsuit and have absolutely no one who will come in and say, I'm with her. And that takes a little bit of fortitude to come in and do that. And frankly, today she's got extended family that comes in and does that for her because her direct family are unable to do that for various reasons. And so I think that speaks to Ms. Shabusiness's character because there's people in this world who find value and worth in her that they're willing to come in and stand behind her. So I think that reflects on character. I'm cognizant of the fact that she began using drugs at a very young age, marijuana at age 12, cocaine at around 18, and methamphetamine at around 18 as well. And we've heard a lot of testimony about drug usage. I don't have any doubt that that has an impact on how people conduct their lives and behave from moment to moment. But quite frankly, as far as this incident and these events go, I think I've spoken to this already in prior hearings, but the fact of the matter is, when I watched the interview with law enforcement shortly after these events, I observed someone who was lucid, understanding what was going on, was tracking what was being asked of her, answers were tracking. Everything seemed to be together at that moment. I don't really see the influence of drugs now. It doesn't mean it's not there, but I didn't see it in that interview, which is the most close proximity to the events of this night that we have is that interview. And right then and there, she seemed to be very lucid in what she was doing. But I don't doubt that there's a long history of drug use, serious drug use. Methamphetamine is a plague in this community, and it seeped into this case as well. And it's something that we have to constantly fight against. It's not a battle that the system wins often, but we're making some headway, and every little step we take is perhaps one life that can be saved as a result of that drug coming into this community. But it's a big problem, and it is in this case. I've heard about Ms. Shabusiness's mental health history. I've read stacks and stacks of mental health records that have come in as recently as a few days ago. And I read them over, which allowed me to learn even more about Ms. Shabusiness and about her character and who she is as a person. I've heard about her son who lives in Texas. And I'm absolutely convinced that she loves her son. I'm going to say more about that in a minute, but that's a piece of who she is because she's a mom. And I think that is a title that is a precious title, and it's an important title. I'm also convinced that a person comes into this court with their life up to that point in time as a demonstration of their character. What kind of a person are they? What do they bring to the table as a member of the human community? Not just this community, but as a community, the human community as a whole. And there are some things about Ms. Shabusiness that speak well of that. I was a little bit put off by statement that I read in the pre-sentence investigation report, frankly, from her father. He said on page 17 of that report, "I feel like the system could have helped Taylor and kind of failed her as well." And I reflected on that because it's difficult to understand who people refer to when they say the system fails people. Because you know what? It's not the job of the system to raise people's children. The system tries to do that. The system is not perfect. Like, our fight against methamphetamine is not perfect, but we carry the fight on. People in our community get into the system, be that the court system or the system dealing with child protection. Really, I think what they're referring to, I don't know, but it seems to be the government. The government needs to come in and do more to take care of people who have gone astray. And I'm not sure that that's the case. Nonetheless, attempts are made. Attempts are being made in this courthouse every day. And to suggest that somehow it's the system that failed, it always surprises me a little bit when people come into court. They're coming in an orange jumpsuit and chains to suggest that it's the system that's failed my daughter. There's a certain irony in that. There really is. And it disturbed me when I read that piece. I'm not so sure it's really relevant to what should happen to Ms. Shabusiness, but it was relevant to what I heard from this witness here today, because I think the system does the best it can. It's imperfect, and it has very much to do with the amount of resources that the public wants to put into the system, and those resources are finite. But as I say, in this building, the system is doing everything it can to fight drug use with all of our treatment courts, with everything we do, to try to help push back the plague of drug use that's occurred and that we've heard so much about in this case. So I read that statement. I heard from Ms. Shabusiness's father. He is coming in here to talk about his daughter, who's also going through the system, and I couldn't help but think of everything I heard about Ms. Shabusiness's son. Because it seems to be a cycle. It seems to be just a circle. It's coming around again. So that if he ever finds himself in the situation that his mother finds himself in, where she's the only one he's got left to come in and speak for him, again, I guess it's the system that's done something, but it all starts, frankly, at somebody's home and what they have to offer to their children. And so anyways, I reflect on that. But I'm also convinced that, you know, no one is responsible for where they come from. But you are responsible for where you're going. So there's a lot of tragedy that has occurred in Ms. Shabusiness's life. There really is. I've already reflected on some of that. And it almost seems as if you could apply the phrase, "she never had a chance," to Ms. Shabusiness. But as I said, you're not responsible for where you come from, but you are responsible for the choices you make about where you're going. And Ms. Shabusiness has got to be held responsible for that. And this is the ending of a process that is doing just that. At the same time, I'm absolutely convinced that, irrespective of the sentence that Ms. Shabusiness gets, which in light of these charges is going to be a life sentence, every human being has the ability to move forward and find meaning in their life, and Ms. Shabusiness has that opportunity, just like anybody else in this courtroom. She has the ability to do that, I certainly hope that for her. But all of those things I reflect on when I consider the character of this defendant. Next, I move on to the gravity of the offense. And I sit in this chair often, and I address situations where people have been have lost their lives, or people have been violated terribly, and I always indicate that really the offense in this case can't be overstated, and that seems very appropriate to say that in most cases when there's been such a death or a violation. But in this case, it seems different. In this case, You seem to run out of superlatives when describing what happened in this case. You really do. The list of superlatives don't seem to measure up to what you see, what you hear about, and what we heard about in the trial. This crime offends human decency, it offends human dignity, and it offends the human community. It really does. When someone loses their life needlessly, it's tragic. It really is. It's tragic for family and friends and community. When life is taken by from a person in the fashion that it was in this case, where the victim's remains are cut up and packaged in containers, it's difficult to identify a human nature in those activities. It really is. It's very troubling. It's difficult to recognize the general belonging that most people have for their community. It's difficult to recognize community in anything that happened in this case. This is a small community that we live in, where the web of relationships almost, you know, encompass everyone who lives here, such that people look out for each other and care when something bad happens to one of our members. And in a broader sense, the community we exist in is the human community, as I've reflected on. And these actions are foreign to all of that to all that community, and they shock the community beyond the ability to adequately express in words. They really do. And that's the gravity of this offense. That is the gravity of this offense. There aren't superlatives for it. There aren't really words for it. You can get a sense of it. You can get a sense of it and a feel for it, but there's no really way to express the gravity of this offense. So the need to protect the public is an important factor the court needs to struggle with as well. And in light of what I've just indicated, I think it's plain that there is a need to protect the public in this case. As I said, this behavior seems so removed from the human community as to be unpredictable. It really is. And in a place where this kind of a crime is possible, with no advanced warning signs, and absolutely anything's possible then. Where this kind of a thing is possible, absolutely anything is possible. And from that, the public needs protection. They really do. I've outlined, you know, what I think are aggravating circumstances in this case. There are mitigating circumstances, as I've said. There's things about Ms. Shabusiness regarding her upbringing and what brought her here, the struggles she's had with some mental health issues, and struggling perhaps in the context of those issues with a family who wasn't always as present as they could have been. Those are mitigating sets of circumstances. But all of those things weigh into what this court has to address. So when I consider what is an appropriate sentence, first, I think the law requires that I at least look at least some of these cases. I take a look at probationary sentences. Those aren't appropriate. They would diminish the severity of the offense. But at this time, given all the factors that I have to consider, it's the decision of this court and the judgment of the law that Ms. Shabusiness be sentenced as follows. As to in 22 CF 363, count one, that's the first degree intentional homicide as a repeater. It's a class A felony. Going to impose life imprisonment without the possibility of extended supervision. I believe that's appropriate in light of the findings that I've already made. As far as count two, mutilation of a corpse as a repeater, a class F felony, I'm going to adopt the recommendation of the pre-sentence investigation writer, 7.5 years of initial confinement followed by 4 years of extended supervision. That'll be consecutive to count one. As far as count three, third-degree sexual assault as a repeater, class G felony, I'm going to impose 3 years of initial confinement followed by 4 years of extended supervision. That will be consecutive to count two and count one. As far as the revocation cases, I'm going to impose 1 year of incarceration on each of those counts. Those will run concurrent to the other offenses. I've reviewed, as I've indicated, reviewed both of the pre-sentence investigation reports. There's certainly valuable things in them. I'm going to, as conditions of supervision, I'm going to require no contact with the victim's family, maintain absolute sobriety, a complete SOT assessment and treatment follow-through, obtain and maintain full-time employment, to the extent there's ever supervision, GPS monitoring. I'm going to require an AOD assessment and follow-through, psychological evaluation and follow-through. The recommendations that are contained in the pre-sentence investigation report submitted by the defense indicates or suggests that there be services engaged in for substance abuse and other mental health issues. That's a reasonable suggestion, and I think I've encompassed it in the recommendations that I've made, which is there needs to be a compass evaluation and follow through with any treatment recommendations that are proposed. But again, an AODA assessment and follow through and psychological evaluation so that Ms. Chavisnes can get the help that she needs while she serves the sentence. I'm going to order court costs. It's $538 per count. That's a total of $1,614. That'll be the order of the court. I do need to indicate, as I'm required to at sentencing, that now that Ms. Chavisnes is convicted of a felony, she'll lose her right to vote until it's given back to her by the governor by state law, and she may not possess firearm or wear body armor. Any other record you'd like me to make, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Fralick, any other record?
Your Honor, the 581 days credit for time served.
Any objection to that?
No, and there's an additional 60 days on the revocation case.
No objection to that.
581 days credit on the the first case, and then on the revocation cases, 60 days credit. And that'll be the order of the court. Then, Mr. Fralick, you can go over your client's appeal rights with her.
Yes, I will.
And with that, then, this matter is now concluded. Thank you.
Thank you.
That wraps up the sentencing for Taylor Chavisnes. Looks like she'll be spending the rest of her life behind bars. It's a shame they couldn't go further on that one. That wraps up our coverage. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we follow for you right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.